Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today on our monthly book show, Cookbooks and Books on Chefs and Food, with us Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Elspeth Hay, CAI local food reporter. Hi, Elspeth.
Good morning.
Now, who doesn't like food, right? And it seems like as the fall rolls around, we kind of just, I don't know, automatically gravitate toward the kitchen. So a good time to share some of our favorite cookbooks and, you know, books on food and even chefs. So Jill, get us started.
Well, I would also just like to say it's a delight to have Elspeth on the show. I'm so sorry we're not in the studio, so I couldn't see her directly in front of me. But having listened to her local food report for many years now, it's just a pleasure to have Elspeth joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. It's really nice to be here with you.
And I look forward to, as I always do, but I particularly look forward to hearing what books you brought, because it is such an enormous, enormous group of books one has to choose from when you start
looking at
books about food. And as a reference librarian, I have to say, there are even now reference books about food, specifically books about food, not just food. There's always, you know, there's often been books about food, but this is actually books about food. It's called Food Lit, A Reader's Guide to Epicurean Nonfiction by Melissa Brackney Stoger. And this is actually a book we have in our reference department, which I came across getting ready for this show. And it's astonishing how much. This was published in 2013. We are now in 2020, and I'm sure this book could have been rewritten between 2013 and 2020 and have a completely different group of books. But it breaks things down into food memoirs and autobiographies, food biographies, food travel, food adventure, history of food, food science, investigative food writing, narrative cookbooks, food essays. I mean, every kind of book has been written about food. And for those of you that don't like nonfiction at all, there's also, they have added in the back, for those of you, a food in fiction appendix and a food in mysteries appendix. So there is, and lots of these, it's, again, there's been so much written since then. The mystery section seems to me it could be three times bigger than it is in here, and the fiction as well. But it's a really interesting book, and it shows you how fascinated people are about reading about food. And it's called Food Lit, A Reader's Guide to Epicurean Nonfiction by Melissa Brackney Stoger, and a great place if you're looking for food-related books.
All right. Elspeth, what's your first book?
My first book is by far my favorite cookbook that I own. It's a book by Dorina Allen, who some people call the Julia Child of Ireland. And it's called Forgotten Skills of Cooking. The time-honored ways are the best, with over 700 recipes. And it really covers just about everything. It has a section on foraging that even, you know, across the Atlantic is helpful here. It has a lot about techniques that, making techniques like smoking or preserving approachable to home cooks. You know, she will tell you how to take a whole fresh ham and cure it with salt, and then she'll give you a recipe for Irish soda bread. So there's a huge amount of variety, and I think of it as, it's sort of for me, the way you might use The Joy of Cooking, I use this book. And whenever I have a question about something a little strange or old-fashioned, I check in with Dorina Allen, and she usually has the answer.
Good to know. All right, Jill.
Well, I felt an obligation to bring at least one Cape Cod cookbook, and we have, and this one is a classic, and I had never seen it before. This is, again, one of the great things about doing this show every month. I find things on our shelves I hadn't seen before. This is actually a reprint of a cookbook that was originally published in 1911, and the Village Improvement Society in Barnstable, with a foreword by Joseph Lincoln, put this book together. It's called What We Cook on Cape Cod, and it begins, in fact, and for those of you that don't know Joseph Joseph Lincoln. Joseph Lincoln was a very, very, very popular novelist who lived on Cape Cod. In fact, in Harwichport is where he lived. And there is a, it begins with a foreword, which was written by Joseph Lincoln, which is a poem about Cape Cod, the Cape Cod cookbook. Here's just a little bit of it. A Cape Cod cookbook. You who stray far from the old sand-bordered bay, the cranberry bogs, the tossing pines, the windswept beaches, frothing lines, you city dwellers who, like me, were children playing by the sea, whose fathers manned the vanished ships. Hark, do I hear you smack your lips? And it goes on from there. It's actually a very funny little poem that he's introduced this book. And then you start reading the recipes, and they're both really familiar and really unfamiliar. And there's also a lot of sort of international kind of things in here. For example, I don't know if either of you have ever heard of German puffers. Is that familiar to either one of you?
No.
Well, there's and the rest. I love these recipes because they're very. They assume, I think, a lot of knowledge on the part of the cook that we may not have any longer. So, German puffers. Here's the whole recipe: peel and grate several raw potatoes and drain. To each cupful of potato, add one well-beaten egg and salt and pepper and one tablespoonful of cream. Fry like pancakes in plenty of fat. That is the entire recipe written by E.A. Handy. So I guess, you know, it's like a potato pancake.
Actually sounds good. I love potatoes.
I know. And here's another one, which is for a fried cheese sandwich. They're just so practical.
Fried cheese sandwich, not a grilled cheese,
fried cheese and it's fried cheese sandwiches. So apparently, you know, one is not enough. Put a slice of cheese between two slices of bread and soak in a batter made of one slightly beaten egg and one half cup of milk and a little salt. Fry in butter. Mrs. E.A. Handy also did that recipe, as it happens. In fact, Mrs. E.A. Handy, it appears, has done many, many of these recipes. There are, let me tell you, not one, not two, not three, but four different recipes for donut making. And all of them seem to assume you know how to actually cook the donut. So it's really just about making the batter for the donut, and then you're on your own, because clearly, in 1911, everybody knew how to make donuts on Cape Cod, which I think is really exciting. And
that's
one of my all-time favorites in this book is in the miscellaneous section, which is very miscellaneous in its miscellaneousness. And this one is for... Oh, my gosh. And this one, this one is also from Mrs. E.A. Handy. I did not intentionally pick only Mrs. E.A. Handy, but she has clearly a remarkable set of recipes here. So this one is boiled coffee. The coffee must be freshly ground. Failing that, warm it in the oven, stirring often. Be careful it does not brown any more than when you put it in. For 6 cups, take 6 tablespoonfuls of coffee, 1 yolk of egg, and cold water enough to make a thin paste. Let this stand for 5 minutes or an hour if more convenient. Add 6 cups of cold water. Put over a hot fire, and the minute it begins to boil, stir it down, and then let it boil up once more. Set it where it will keep hot but not boil until it settles. And that is your boiled coffee recipe for the morning.
I don't know about that one, yeah.
definitely no Starbucks there and no Dunkin' Donuts. It seems like quite a process just to make boiled coffee. And
yes.
She does, you know, she's talking about putting it over the fire, and I assume a real fire, but any case, this is called What We Cook on Cape Cod, and it was put together by the Village Improvement Society in Barnstable, Massachusetts in 1911. This is a reprint, and there are a couple of copies of this in its original format in Cape libraries, but they nicely have, for all of the rest of us, it has been reprinted. So, What We Cook on Cape Cod.
Good to know. All right. Molly sent us an email and she says, Erin Gleason has written a series of wonderful vegetarian cookbooks. My favorite is Gatherings. She presents menus for parties from cocktails to dessert in a way that makes it easy for the hostess to prepare everything in advance and be relaxed at her or his own event. Beautiful photos too. Molly, thanks for that suggestion. Since she mentioned a vegetarian cookbook, I'm going to mention one. This cookbook we recently got, you know, I have to say, I have a lot of cookbooks and I go back to my favorite recipes, but I go online a lot, and I've really liked a lot of the recipes from Cookie and Kate. This is her name is Catherine Taylor, and her book is Love Real Food, more than 100 feel-good vegetarian favorites to delight the senses and nourish the body. She's just got some really great recipes that just, I don't, make a lot of sense. Really, you know, I always thought just eating vegetarian would be kind of boring, to be honest. But her recipes are absolutely delicious. And so I would recommend Catherine Taylor's Love Real Food, or check her out online, Cookie and Kate. Cookie is her dog, by the way. So there's that. What have you got, Elspeth?
Well, first I have to jump in and say I also use a lot of recipes from that blog. It's a really good...
Right?
Yeah, it is really good. And I think real food has become kind of a catchphrase. One of the cookbooks that I set aside is by a woman named Nina Plank. She's in New York, and she wrote this book called The Real Food Cookbook, which came after she wrote two really successful nonfiction books about diet and eating. And the first was called Real Food, What to Eat and Why, and then she did a follow-up, Real Food for Mother and Baby. And I read both of those books and found them fascinating. There was a lot about, you know, why the traditional American diet, which I think is sometimes called the standard American diet, or SAD, which is sad. We came up with an acronym like that for our diet. You know, isn't serving a lot of people, and ideas for why that's happening and sort of getting over the fat phobia that was introduced for a while and getting back to real whole foods. And after she wrote those books, there was sort of a clamoring for, you know, okay, great, we're supposed to eat real food, so what are you actually cooking? And this was the cookbook that came out of this, and it's a fantastic cookbook. It's a lot of traditional dishes. The recipe that I actually make the most out of it is for Caesar dressing, which is, you know, not some new earth-shattering thing, but she makes it with all whole ingredients, including the original anchovies and the raw egg, and I love the flavor of it. I love what she's done with it, and most of the recipes in this book are like that. They're not reinventing the wheel necessarily, but they're whole foods takes on recipes that may have changed over the years. She also has a chocolate mousse, for instance, that calls for 8 eggs. And you realize, wow, okay, if you're going to make a mousse without a ton of sugar, you actually have to pony up and buy almost a dozen eggs and a lot of butter. And it's excellent. She does a custard that you can use a real squash with. So she kind of goes back to basics with a lot of ingredients and also focuses a lot on seafood and vegetables. And her husband is a cheesemonger, so there's also some great tips on buying cheese and cheese plates. And all in all, it's a really great book. Like I said, nothing, you know, that's totally new and different, but just good ways to make those classics that you're craving.
And what's the name of it again?
It's The Real Food Cookbook by Nina Plank.
Great. And we'd love to hear if you have thoughts on cookbooks or books on food that you'd like to share with us for our list this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. We're talking about cookbooks and books on chefs and food this morning with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Elspeth Hay, CAI local food reporter. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What's next, Jill?
The next book I brought is not exactly a cookbook, but it's sort heard of a cookbook, and it gives a lot of advice about cooking. It's called An Everlasting Meal, Cooking with Economy and Grace by Tamar Adler. And I had never seen this book before this show, and I am just so happy to have found it. It is really sort of essays on cooking rather than a lot of specifics necessarily. She writes in her intro, this is not a cookbook or a memoir or a story about one person or one thing. It is a book about eating affordably, responsibly, and well. And because doing so relies on cooking, it is mostly about that. And she had apparently worked, she has worked in many great restaurants, but the book itself has got, every chapter is a how-to chapter. So there was how to boil water, how to teach an egg to fly, how to catch your tail, how to light a room, all kinds of things you can learn how to do. But some of it is just so beautifully written. She's a really great writer, as being obviously a very great cook. And the chapter that really caught my attention was a chapter called How to Build a Ship. And here's just a little bit from that chapter. She begins, there are times when I can't bear to think about cooking. Food is what I love and how I communicate love and how I calm myself. But sometimes, without my knowing why, it is drained of all that. Then cooking becomes just another one of hunger's jagged edges. So I have ways to take hold of this thing and wrest it from the claws of resentment and settle it back among things that are mine. The first is remembering that ill-tempered as I am, I resent everything sometimes. I get infuriated by the weather and missed trains and missing buttons. I think that cooking must be allowed to swell to contemptible proportions when it seems contemptible, just like other disproportionately terrible annoyances, and then allowed to shrink when it is time. Then the question is, how do you fall in love with it again? Or if it has never made you truly happy, fall in love with it for the first time. My answer is to anchor food to somewhere deep inside you, or deep in your past, or deep in the wonders of what you love. We have different loves. Mine are food and words. Others are how buildings slant away from dark sidewalks, or how good it feels to solve an equation. I say, let yourself love what you love and see if it doesn't lead you back to what you ate when you loved it. This whole chapter is really gorgeous, and she brings in Wind of the Willows and the picnic and Wind of the Willows that happens, and she ends it this way. For a week, I had a solid sense that my days were a cool river. I made cold beef and pickled onion sandwiches for lunch and ate watercress salad and drank not lemonade but beer. I am probably most helped by reading books written by people who were moved by what they ate and could not tell a story without telling what was eaten. Ernest Hemingway, who never made explicit what could be implied, could not help describing food. He wrote about foods that were wild and cold, oysters, brook trout, wine. And when I read this one, which I do when I'm really embittered about cooking and eating and being hungry in the first place, I think, oh, yes, and something settles. In A Movable Feast, he wrote, as I ate the oysters with their strong taste of the sea and their faint metallic taste that the cold white wine washed away, leaving only the sea taste and the succulent texture, and as I drank their cold liquid from each shell and washed it down with the crisp taste of the wine, I lost the empty feeling and began to be happy and to make plans. So that is the chapter called How to Build a Ship, from An Everlasting Meal by Tamar Adler. Highly recommend this beautiful book. It will make you want to cook, even if you're not a cook.
I do have to ask a question, though, Jill. Do we really need directions on how to boil water?
Well, apparently, yes. In fact, yes. And I think what she's trying to get at is that you have to start with the basics, right? And you have to start with knowing. And she does go into great detail about how to boil water, and what should, you know, potatoes should be started in cold water, as should eggs. That sort of thing is in that how to boil water chapter. So, yes, I'd say, and especially, again, for those of us who don't necessarily cook or who live with somebody who cooks a lot. This is an inspiring book.
All right. Thank you. All right. Elspeth.
I have to follow up on that boiling water by saying that I think that we do maybe need to be taught how to boil water. I have a friend who was leaving instructions for someone who was just learning how to cook and started with, like, cook the pasta, and that was not quite enough for someone.
Oh, no.
So there, you know, every step helps, and you have to start at the beginning.
Yeah.
The book that I want to talk about next is Dinner, A Love Story by Jenny Rosenstrach, and this is sort of a book like that, about starting at the beginning. It's a book for anyone with a job or a family who's hungry, so most people. And it's all about keeping dinner not overwhelming and simple. And it talks a lot about her kids and her family and how to get around picky eaters. And she considers it she believes in everyone eating the same thing, but she says she'll consider it that everyone's eating the same thing if, say, the grown-ups are having all the vegetables in a salad and the kids maybe have a few slices of the same vegetables on the side of her plate. So she's flexible with the rules, but she also has rules, which I love. And I've gotten some really great recipes from here that we make again and again. One is for fish cakes, and I love the introduction to this recipe. She writes, "You will often read that fish cakes are a good solution for leftover fish. My answer to that is, if you make fish cakes on the first night instead of the second, there is no chance of having any leftovers in the first place." I just love that. And we do actually often make fish on its own, but we also go straight to the fish cakes, and they take any kind of flaky white fish. I often use flounder since it's local and affordable. And you bake them with a little sprinkle of chili powder, dried oregano, and salt and pepper. And then that only takes, I want to say, like 5 or 10 minutes. And then very quickly after that, you mix them with mayo and an egg, a little bit of lime juice, and a baked potato. And I don't know what happens. You add a little handful of cilantro and some breadcrumbs, and then suddenly you have these absolutely amazing fish cakes that my kids eat. My family loves, my parents have raved about them, and they're totally addictive. I love to eat them also the next day if you have leftover fish cakes. There's nothing I like better than sautéing some greens and then having a fish cake with a fried egg on top.
Wow, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, it is. It's great. And all her recipes are sort of in that same category of very simple, very satisfying, and crowd pleasers. So this is a book that I go back to again and again. Again, that's Dinner, A Love Story by Jenny Rosenstrach. And she also has a blog, and you'll find her in other places. But this is a great resource.
You'll have to check her out. All right, Joan is giving us a call from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning, ladies. Two books that I'm calling about today is, one is Cooking the Catch by Dave Mash.
Oh, yes.
And it's a spirited collection of recipes based on the catch of the day. And I go back to this quite frequently. And I like to have fish frequently. And the other book I'm calling about is the one Jill mentioned, What We Cook on Cape Cod by the Barnstable Ladies, and with the foreword by Joseph C. Lincoln. And he wrote this in Harwichport in August of 1911, and I think probably my grandmother would have used this book if she was living here on the Cape, because they had a coal stove. My father was born in 1911, and she cooked on a coal stove, so she would have understood these recipes completely.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Because they don't have any oven temperatures or anything like
right,
that.
Exactly.
That's funny, yeah. All right, Joan, thanks. That's a good mentions. Thank you for that. I should mention that we will have a list of all the books we talk about at our website later today, capeandislands.org. Thanks for calling, Joan. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. James is calling from Harwich. Hi, James.
Good morning, everybody. I'm calling to promote a restaurant-specific cookbook from a restaurant in Exeter, New Hampshire. It's the Loaf and Ladle restaurant, and they specialize in bread and soups and stews, and they're all delicious. And, they have an excellent selection. They do everything. They have an excellent chowder. There's a lot of diversity of opinion of whether chowder should be really thick or should be just peppery and leave the broth thin.
Mm-hmm. And the name of the book again, James, is what?
The Loaf and Ladle Cookbook.
The Loaf and Ladle. Great. Okay, Loaf and Ladle. Thank you for that suggestion. We'll check that out. Thanks for calling. Rosalie is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Rosalie.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Great.
One of my favorite books when I'm on the Cape is The Cape Cod Table by Laura Brody. And she says, the recipes in the book reflect not only my dearly held associations and memories of season past, but the mood that comes upon me as I drive over the bridge, anticipating precious time to walk the beaches, the woods, the meadows of the Cape. So one of the recipes I make in it all the time and bring every week to Mass Appeal, because I volunteer and I bring it for the volunteers, is her Cape Cod, her scones. And everybody says they're the best scones, and everybody always asks me for the recipes. So it's a fabulous book. And the other book that I love is The Perla Meyer's Seasonal Kitchen, which is a classic, I think, and it's really fabulous.
Great. Thank you for those suggestions, Rosalie. We appreciate that. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to suggest a cookbook or book about food for us. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what have you got next?
Well, I recently got the most current issue of a magazine called Bookmarks, which comes out monthly, and it's, as they say, for everyone who hasn't read everything. And as it happened, there was a whole article about food and memoirs, and they actually have now coined the word foodwar instead of memoir for books which are basically cookbook meets memoir. And they've become incredibly popular in all sorts of ways. This particular issue of the magazine has all kinds of suggestions for it, but the one that has caught my eye is a book called Always Home, A Daughter's Recipe and Stories by Fanny Singer. And Fanny Singer, as it happens, is the daughter of Alice Waters. And if anybody has spent like 5 minutes looking for cookbooks, you'll see that Alice Waters is everywhere. She is a very popular chef, and her daughter is now also grew up basically in the restaurant where her mother was running the restaurant. And it's sort of funny because she says this book just got published, and she was supposed to go on the road with and talk about the book, but of course she got stuck at home just like everybody else. And in an interview with her in Vanity Fair, she says, it is not lost on me that I selected the title Always Home for my book, and now I am quite literally always home. And it is basically it's an autobiography, but it's a lot more than that. It's an autobiography that's full of recipes and also full of her childhood memories of growing up with this mother who is running the restaurant at the same time as she's raising a daughter. She hears a little bit about also goes back to the show, in fact, about colors. This whole chapter is called Maroon and Chartreuse, and just listen to a little bit of this. One of the questions I used to ask my mother repeatedly when I was small and possessed a proportionately limited imagination was, what's your favorite color? To my mom's credit, she kept things interesting, always furnishing me with the same wonderfully erudite answer, maroon and chartreuse. It's a tie. I love them both. I love them together. I can't choose. she would trill from the front seat if she was driving, a favorite time to pepper her with banal inquiries, or from the kitchen if I was asking the well-worn question from another room, or perhaps from across the butcher block while she prepared something at the stove. Maroon and chartreuse, two lesser-known shades of the tried-and-true complementary pair of purple and yellow. On some level, those two colors sum it up. They give a perfectly concise picture of the aesthetic universe my mom has crafted and insists on living in. And this book is not only full of stories about growing up in a restaurant. It also has these great photographs, both older and newer photographs of food and the restaurant. And she has a little bit in here about Thanksgiving, which is coming right up. She says, anyway, when it comes to Thanksgiving, it's a matter of finding balance. Even though the Thanksgiving feast is a meal filled with flourishes in excess, it is nonetheless often defined by the simplest dishes. And if you're looking to make a dinner that in any way resembles my mother's, insist on serving a salad at the end, an uncomplicated one. Just winter greens like chicories, endives, and frise with a handful of parsley leaves, even if everyone around the table groans and protests and claims they can't eat another bite, remind them, as she does, that there's no better digestive, and pass a big bowl of it around regardless. So she's getting you ready for Thanksgiving as well. And it's just a really beautiful tale about her life, and in which she literally was, they used to put her when she was a baby in a salad bowl, so she was safe in the kitchen, which gives you an idea of how ingrained in her cooking is, and her love for her mother comes through, and the traveling that they did is in here as well. It's beautifully written. Her mother does, Alice Waters does the foreword, and it is called Always Home, A Daughter's Recipes and Stories by Fanny Singer.
We have a note from Peter from Yarmouth. He says, this is not about books, but can your guest explain the difference between a stock and a broth? What is the purpose of each, and which is more healthy? That sounds like a question for you, Elspeth.
Yeah, I would agree.
No. You don't know?
I know who would know, though. I'm going to reach over for that Real Food Cookbook by Nina Plank. She has a whole...
Well, you know what? I'm going to give you a chance to look that up while we take a break then. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Stay tuned. We'll find out the difference between a stock and a broth. And you're listening to The Point. We're talking about books on cookbooks, books on food, chefs. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us this morning is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Elspeth Hay, CAI local food reporter. What'd you find out, Elspeth? Do we know what the difference between a stock and a broth is?
Well, I'm getting conflicting reports. Some places to use them interchangeably, and other places say that stock is a little more bare bones, made with literally the bones, and broth has more meat when the simmering is happening. So I'm not sure if that is universal, but I did find a little bit about the health, the healthiness of one versus the other, or just broth and stocks in general using bones. The bones are a key ingredient because that is what sort of stretches the protein offering of the meat. So the book that I'm reading, which is that Nina Plank Real Food Cookbook, says the frugal cook in particular understands the value of broth. It makes use of the odd bits of the animal, cartilage, neck bones, knuckles, feet. Although it provides little, if any, complete protein, it is a protein stretcher, meaning that it helps the body efficiently use available protein. That's why it's a staple of protein-poor cuisines, and why the ration-era Bovril ads in Britain featured a cow made of vegetables. The accurate implication is that a bit of Bovril, essentially reduced beef stock, could stretch even vegetables into something that resembles a steak.
Hmm. All right, good. Thank you for that.
It also has the tip to add a little bit of acid, like a lemon juice, or even vinegar, just a tablespoon or something, and that helps pull the minerals out of the bones. So that's another.
Okay. Good to know. All right, let's talk to Becky, who's giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Becky.
Hi, good morning. And I wanted to share this book. It's called The Encyclopedia of Healing Foods, and it's written by Michael Murray, a naturopathic doctor, and Joseph Pisorno, also a naturopathic doctor. And it's a book of about 800 pages, and it breaks it down in sections about the principles of a good diet, food components, a section on healing foods, and then it breaks it down to the individual characteristics of the healing power of grains, healing power of beans, healing power of nuts, seeds, and oils, healing power of herbs and spices, of fish and shellfish, the healing power of milk and dairy, the healing power of meat and poultry, and then the healing power of miscellaneous foods. And then there's a whole section on food prescriptions for specific diseases. Mm-hmm. And then they included five appendixes, which teaches about carbohydrates, acid alkaline values, pesticide content of fruits or vegetables, food and drug interactions, and then it has a huge reference section for anyone that wants to look into, you know, something specifically. But right. Each section, whether it's fruits or vegetables, has a section on the history of the food, the nutritional highlights, and how to select and store, tips for preparing, and quick serving ideas. So
wow.
It's comprehensive and, you know, very handy for so many needs. And it's also user-friendly because it's alphabetized and
What Becky, tell us the name of it again. It's what the name of the book again?
So it's called The Encyclopedia of Healing Foods.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We'll put that on our list. Thanks for making that suggestion. Appreciate that. Let's talk to Jane calling from East Ham. Hi, Jane.
Hi, good morning, foodies. I love it. I have three books. I'm interested in your reaction. I have hundreds of cookbooks, and I've been collecting cookbooks since as early as I can remember. I have my first one, I think, when I was three. So what about Ruth Reichel? She was the last gourmet editor, and she wrote some really good books and some nice recipes, you know, within the pages. And it's fun how she used to dress up so people wouldn't recognize her when she wanted to review a restaurant. That's one. The newest one that maybe people don't know is Smitten Kitchen by Deb Perlman. She also has a blog, excellent blog with pictures. She talks about the stories. She works out of a tiny little apartment in New York City with two children now. And the last one is my most favorite, is a Fanny Farmer Boston Cooking School cookbook.
Yeah,
I love it. I
have my mother's copy of that.
Okay. All right. Then now, just real quick, Jane, tell us the Ruth's book again. Which one of Ruth's books did you recommend?
Ruth Reichel. You just have to look her up and find. She has a number of them. They're all
okay.
Good.
And Deb Perlman's book was called?
R-E-I-C-H-L.
Yep. And what was Deb Perlman's book?
Smitten Kitchen Every Day is the one I have. And
okay, great.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of Deb Perlman and Smitten Kitchen.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Jane, for those suggestions. Melinda is giving us a call from East Ham. Hi, Melinda.
Hello. Good morning. I was calling because of the conversation about the Fanny Singer book, and I wanted to add on to that there's a great book about Alice Waters for anyone who's interested in sort of the trajectory of American cooking and thinking about seasonality and the conversation about whole foods. So it's called Alice Waters and Chez Panisse, the romantic, impractical, often eccentric, ultimately brilliant making of a food revolution, and it's by Thomas Massamy. And it's very readable and really interesting if you're interested in any of those sort of topics. So it's not recipes, it's just so you learn about Alice Waters, and then you could follow up with Fanny Singer's book, and then you'd have the full,
there you go,
the full suite.
All right, great. Melinda, thanks for that. We appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what have you got next?
Well, this is a book that I think Elspeth could have written. And in fact, she may know the author. I don't know. It is called The Fruit Forager's Companion, Ferments, Desserts, Main Dishes, and More from Your Neighborhood and Beyond by Sarah Burr, B-I-R. And she begins by saying, I'm not a foraging expert, and I'm not a botanist. I'm a physically restless chef who likes plants. I'm attracted to fruit because plants develop their fruit to be attractive to animals, and I am a curious animal following their lead. I don't generate any income from foraging, and the food I bring home represents a tiny sliver of my annual diet. But even if I come back from an outing empty-handed, which is most of the time, I return enriched because there's always something new to see. I don't just gather food, I gather observations. And what she does in this book is she has a whole list of fruits that you can forage that you do not have to go to your local grocery store to buy necessarily, and that are then, she has recipes to go with all of these various things. So there's blueberries, blackberries. I live with somebody who just waits for the blackberries to come out around town and is convinced he knows where all the best patches are. crab apples, cranberries, elderberries, figs, gooseberries, ground cherries. You get the idea, but also lemons, limes, mulberries, oranges. And it is a really fascinating book. It is full of photographs as well. It also tells you all the things you should not pick that you might want to stay away from, which is also helpful. As Publishers Weekly said, this charming and eminently useful guide from Pace Magazine food editor and writer Burr deserves a spot on the bookshelf of any foraging foodie. Instead of serving up a simple list of fruits and vegetables with tips on canning, Burr weaves in personal anecdotes and trivia about, among other things, the advent of commercial pectin, patented in 1913, and the curious history of key limes once pickled and served as snacks for school children. And I would also say about this book that it is published by Chelsea Green Publishing. And if you don't know Chelsea Green Publishing, you should. They're based in White River Junction, Vermont. You can go to their webpage, chelseagreen.com, and find all kinds of wonderful recipes. As they describe what they do, it's the politics and practice of sustainable living. Think for yourself, read for the world. And since 1984, Chelsea Green has been the leading publisher of books about organic farming, gardening, homesteading, and sustainable living. So I recommend this book as well as their other books. This is The Fruit Forager's Companion by Sarah Burr. That's B-I-R.
All right, let's talk to Harry calling from Chilmark. Hi, Harry.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just have a quick cookbook I have a lot of cookbooks and realized after a while that I wasn't actually cooking out of them. You know, I get ideas and stuff like that. But one of my favorite new cookbooks is it's called Food Lab, and I don't know who it's by because I'm in a car. But it talks more about the why and the science and how food cooks in different ways and what makes it, you know, better or worse. It's a really neat book. It's for people who, like, want to understand, you know, why if you salt your eggs, it comes out different than if you don't. Or
yeah,
you know,
Harry, tell us the name again. I think you're breaking up a little bit. What was the name of the book?
It is The Food Lab. The Food Lab, L-A-B.
Food Lab. Okay, great. Thank you, Harry. We got
a
number of
excellent cookbook.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, Harry. I got a few emails here. Mary says, I recommend My Bread by Jim Lay, which is great, by the way. I have that cookbook, who invented the no-knead bread method using an overnight rise and preheated Dutch oven to get that crispy crust. One tip, place the dough on parchment paper for the final rise, then use the edges to lift it into the preheated Dutch oven. Keeps fresh for days. Just place cut side down on cutting board and counter. She says, I began using this book in my small apartment when New York City was in shock. bridges and airports closed, fighter jets patrolling the skies in the weeks after 9/11. I return to it this shutdown when I've been making the steka, a small baguette. Super easy, makes 3 or 4 13-inch loaves, freezes beautifully, makes wonderful sandwiches. Mary, thanks for that. Richard recommends Patrick O'Brien fans Lobscous and Spotted Dog, which is a gastronomic companion to the Aubrey Mautern novels. Thank you for that. Faith says The Irish Cookbook by J.P. McMahon, Traditional and Modern Cooking, Myth and Nature Stories, and Great Recipes for Indoors and Grill. And see you on Sunday, Sam Sifton. Thank you, Faith, for that. Denya says Silk Road Cooking, A Vegetarian Journey by Najami, I'm going to say B-A-T-M-A-N-G-L-I-J. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. She says it is available in the Clam system. She also says she never tires of the Moosewood cookbooks. Thank you for that.
Can I just say about the Moosewood cookbook, Dan Tridle also loves the Moosewood cookbooks, which he told me when we just before we went on air.
Yeah. And then let's see, we have Marcia from Cumaquid says Indian Herbology of North America by Almond Hutchins has led me to find, identify, and use native plants. So that's some great suggestions we've got there. Elspeth, what have you got next?
I have a book from Sarah Waldman, which she's on Martha's Vineyard. It's called Feeding a Family, A Real Life Plan for Making Dinner Work. And it is exactly that. And I'm realizing as I talk, I keep coming back to these books that help you get dinner on the table as a parent. I think a lot of us feel like we've cooked more in the past few months than ever before, even if we're avid cooks. And this is a beautiful book. It was photographed by Elizabeth Cecil, who's also on the vineyard. I'm slightly biased because she featured a couple of my recipes in it. It's gorgeous, and one recipe that we keep coming back to again and again, it's all organized by season, and she has an oven-baked falafel with garden radishes, cucumber, and pea shoots. That's one of the summer recipes. We also cheat and make it in the winter, but it has, you just use canned chickpeas. You don't go through the process of cooking them like some other falafel recipes. It's super easy, very approachable, and they're all balanced meals that you feel good about feeding to your family. So highly recommended. My kids were just paging through it right before this and got fixated on some rhubarb sundaes. So I guess we know what we're doing next spring. But we're going into fall, and there's a great whole section on fall recipes too, so I would definitely recommend checking this out. Again, that's Feeding a Family by Sarah Waldman.
I got about a minute and a half, Jill.
And just, I don't want to run out of time without mentioning just a couple of mysteries. Dorothy Sayre's Strong Poison has a food in it. A lot of Georges Simenon's mysteries do. Maigret's Dead Man would be one to start with. And I also would recommend Rex Stout. There's a collection of novellas called Three at Wolf's Door. This is a wonderful story about this big dinner. It's called Poison a la Carte. And it starts with a whole description of what the table looks like and what's the cooking, because Nero Wolfe, being the detective, also happens to have a cook that cooks for him exclusively. And, of course, there's this big dinner happening. There are 12 people around the table, and there are 12 women that are serving. It's intensely sexist as well as, or shall we just say, of its time, but really fun nonetheless. It's called Poison a la Carte. One of the people at this big dinner that they're having is, of course, poisoned and dies, and Nero Wolfe has to decide who it is that killed which one of these women who were at this event and serving at the event might have killed this person.
And so just real quick, I want to mention Philip Craig also, his mysteries also
have
lots
of food
in
them.
I think there was actually a book he did of the recipes as well. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Elspeth Hay, CAI local food reporter, thanks so much for sharing your cookbooks with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody that called and wrote.
I know we got some great suggestions, and again, we will put that list together and have it up on our website later today, capeandislands.org. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.